Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to another episode of If You Love This Planet. On the show today, we're speaking with Jacqueline Cabasso, Executive Director of the Western States Legal Foundation in California. Jackie is a leading voice for nuclear weapons abolition and peace. In 1995, she was a founding mother of the Abolition 2000 Global Network to Eliminate Nuclear Weapons. She also serves on the National Steering Committee of the organization United for Peace and Justice. Jackie Cabasso has written articles and op-eds for publications, including the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and since 2007 has served as North American Coordinator for Mayors for Peace. Cabasso is a co-author of a report released by the New York-based Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy in 2007. The report is called Nuclear Disorder or Cooperative Security: U.S. Weapons of Terror, the Global Proliferation Crisis, and Paths to Peace. The publication is an assessment of the final report of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission and its implications for U.S. policy. Jacqueline Cabasso was awarded the prestigious Sean McBride Peace Prize by the International Peace Bureau in November 2008, and she joins me now. Welcome, Jackie.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we've just covered a fair bit of ground just in your introduction. Where do you think the US and the world stands now on nuclear weapons in general?
Well, I think we're in a really dangerous time, a dangerous moment, which is also a moment of opportunity. But it is particularly dangerous because of the past 8 years of the Bush administration, but even more than that, the period of totally squandered opportunity in the 90s after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when President Bill Clinton really had an opportunity to lead the world decisively towards the elimination of nuclear weapons and did not, instead reaffirming the status quo and making it possible then for the Bush administration to come in and really take some rather over-the-top positions and make the threatened first use of nuclear weapons and all kinds of contingencies very apparent, although that had always been U.S. policy.
Partly
as a result, now we have a situation where Russia feels threatened by the United States, by its overwhelming conventional superiority, and also feels threatened by the expansion of NATO right up to its borders. And now Russia is talking quite openly about modernizing its conventional and its strategic nuclear forces starting in 2011. At the same time, now we have a new president, Obama, who has said some things that sound good. He has said that he wants to lead the way to a world without nuclear weapons. But if you look at what he's saying a little more closely, he then says that as long as nuclear weapons exist, we will maintain a strong nuclear deterrent. And he also keeps reaffirming his commitment to having the strongest military on Earth. So, as I said, I think there's some opening there. And then we have the economic collapse, which calls everything into question and also exacerbates the dangers, I think, of wars between major powers over resources in coming years, and those major powers have nuclear weapons.
Well, then let's go back. You've just summarized a huge amount of material in that short time, Jackie. Talk about what Bill Clinton did and failed to do.
Just to refresh everybody's memories, the Soviet Union quietly disappeared overnight. about 1990 after the Berlin Wall fell. And at that time, of course, and the United States, this was still under George Bush, the first George Bush, the United States, you know, welcomed Russia as its friend, and it was actually Bush who unilaterally withdrew an entire class of nuclear weapons from active service, those deployed on surface ships. Clinton came in, and in 1994, oversaw the first nuclear posture review, which was a top-to-bottom review of U.S. nuclear policy, and unfortunately reaffirmed the Cold War status quo, creating a nuclear posture that was based on lead and hedge. In other words, while anticipating some reductions in the numbers of nuclear weapons, also making provisions for increased numbers of nuclear weapons and modernization of nuclear weapons. Then in 1995, the United States was very insistent and heavy-handed in ensuring that the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty would be extended indefinitely and without conditions. Now, that treaty in Article 6 obligates the United States and the other four recognized nuclear weapon states to end the nuclear arms race at an early date and to negotiate in good faith the elimination of their nuclear arsenals. That treaty entered into force in 1970, becoming domestic law in the United States and the other countries that are states' parties. And yet, here we are today, how many, 35, 40 years later, with about 25,000 nuclear weapons in the world. So Clinton, however, in connection with that indefinite extension, the rest of the world made it pretty clear that they expected completion of a comprehensive test ban treaty. And so in 1996, the United States was actually the first country to sign the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. But then President Clinton loaded it up with conditions to try to get the Senate to ratify it. And those conditions mandated the creation of a system of laboratory-based experiments and supercomputers that would functionally replace underground nuclear testing and allow the United States to continue with modernization and research development and modernization of nuclear weapons. And
why do you think Clinton was so limp-wristed and pathetic?
That's a good question. He certainly was. He was a pretty much of a centrist as a Democrat, and he was a militarist.
Why was he a militarist? He'd just come from
United States has a long history of militarism.
But was he just emulating what past presidents had done, and was he intimidated by the Pentagon, do you think, Jackie?
Well, I think he was basically carrying on in the historical tradition of U.S. Militarism and imperialism, in particular, though, with regard to nuclear weapons. In 1997, under this Presidential Decision Directive 60, he reaffirmed the threatened first use of nuclear weapons as a cornerstone of U.S. national security policy and contemplated an expanded role for nuclear weapons to deter, quote-unquote, deter not only nuclear but also chemical or biological weapons, and that's one of the ways in which the threshold to nuclear weapons use was lowered. Now, every American president has affirmed that posture one way or another since President Truman, who was a Democrat, ordered the first use of nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. So there's a tremendous military constituency for nuclear weapons, but there's also, and I think this is what you're getting at, there's a tremendous scientific and military industrial complex constituency for nuclear weapons, because the nuclear weapons laboratories are the direct descendants historically of the Manhattan Project, which was the name of the super secret, super expensive crash program to develop nuclear weapons in the 1940s. And instead of after World War II, after the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, instead of closing the Manhattan Project, it was made into a permanent institution called the Los Alamos National Laboratory. And then in 1952, Another laboratory was established in Livermore, California, which is near my office, about 35 miles. And that the mission of that lab actually was to compete with Los Alamos to develop a hydrogen bomb orders of magnitude more destructive than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. And so it was always, the laboratories always considered themselves to be competitors, and they would joke that the real arms race isn't between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, it's between the U.S. and between the two weapons laboratories. And that competition has continued right up to the present. In the last few years, they've been competing with each other over designs for a new warhead called a reliable replacement warhead, although that program hasn't been funded for the last couple of years.
Okay, so let's go back to Clinton, because we'll get into the reliable. He had a most extraordinary opportunity, didn't he, after the end of the Cold War, to reach...
And before the war on the so-called war on terror, absolutely.
And to reach out to President Yeltsin, who was a very hardened alcoholic, who was very compliant with the United States, and he could have got Yeltsin to sign an agreement to abolish nuclear weapons bilaterally. After all, America and Russia owned and now own most of the nuclear weapons in the world. He could have got Yeltsin to agree to do that, and he failed. I mean, I have to say that I place the present global nuclear weapons situation right on Clinton's shoulders.
Well, I tend to share that view because I was working very hard throughout the 90s to try to change, you know, to create some public sentiment to change the position. And I tend to agree with you. And that's one of the reasons why I'm very wary about Hillary Clinton's position and influence as the Secretary of State. I mean, of course, I don't assume that her views are exactly the same as her husband's, but it is worrying.
And then, well, I don't even think we need to walk through the Bush era. It was so disgusting in terms of nuclear weapons and first use, and Cheney sort of sitting behind the curtain like the Wizard of Oz, orchestrating the whole thing and threatening non-nuclear nations with use of nuclear weapons, you know, annihilating them. So, in particular, Jackie Cabasso, I wanted to interview you today because you are probably the world expert, if you will, on what those nuclear weapons labs, the Wizard of Oz again, have been doing all these years and what they're doing now. And in particular, to discuss the stockpile and... What is it, SSNM?
The Stockpile Stewardship Program.
That's right.
The National Health Care Plan for Aging Nuclear Weapons in a country that has no national health care.
National Health Care for Aging Nuclear Weapons. I mean, you introduced me to, and I love it, SSNM, you know, sadomasochistic, you know, stuff. But it is. How did this blasted program begin at the labs? Who dreamt it up? And what's it all about? And I mean, we can go into these huge bloody supercomputers and all sorts of things that the labs have developed to emulate nuclear explosions and possible real live nuclear tests again being reintroduced into the desert in Nevada. But how did SSNM start? During what era did it begin? Whose brainchild was it? And what are they up to, these labs, Jackie?
Well, we talked about this a little bit already under Clinton when it came out under that name. But actually, it goes back to the Manhattan Project. The actual types of experiments involving fissile materials and chemical high explosives go back to the very early days of the development of the first atomic bombs. And something I like to remind people of who think that we need this complex to maintain the safety and reliability of the enduring arsenal, and we should unpack that a bit, don't seem to remember that from a knowledge base of nothing. In less than 3 years, the U.S. built bombs that decimated two Japanese cities and, you know, incinerated 200,000 people. But all along, the laboratories in those days, they would, well, I should also say that the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima was not, had not been tested. It had never been tested. It was, there were only three bombs that were built in 1945. The first one was a plutonium bomb that was tested in at Trinity in New Mexico, Alamogordo, New Mexico. It worked. The second one was the Hiroshima bomb, which had never been tested. The third one was another plutonium bomb dropped on Nagasaki. But after that, when the nuclear weapons laboratories and supporting production facilities were institutionalized as part of the nuclear weapons complex, the scientists relied on full-scale explosive testing to see if their designs worked. And in the, so that they would work on the designs in the laboratories, then they would take the components out to the Nevada test site or to some Pacific island or Marshall Islands or whatever, and actually construct the bomb and detonate it. And so there, and in the age, in the days when they were trying to make more and more high explosive bombs, H bombs, these H bombs, they were enormous, huge, ungodly above ground tests in which many people were hurt, particularly in the Marshall Islands, but also U.S. soldiers who were taken into Ground Zero and essentially used as human guinea pigs. In 1960, the Soviet Union, I believe it was 60, initiated a moratorium on nuclear testing, and the United States joined in. But then when the Soviet Union broke out of that moratorium, it led to a series of negotiations that resulted in a partial test ban treaty that would banned above-ground tests but expanded the underground testing program. And that actually, I would say, is really the beginning of stockpile stewardship, because in 1963, President Kennedy attached a set of safeguards to Senate ratification of the partial test ban treaty, which ensured incentives to attract and retain the brightest, most talented human resources, that being the scientists, expanded the budget for the nuclear weapons laboratories, and provided for an expanded underground nuclear testing program. And so instead of a comprehensive test ban treaty, which at that time would have actually made it very difficult to modernize nuclear weapons or develop new ones, nuclear testing went underground. And that was also around the time when the nuclear arms race really took off between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and the yield of the weapons and the numbers of the weapons in the stockpiles just went, you know, beyond our human capacity to imagine.
Went Burko. Jackie, we're getting a bit of sort of popping in the phone. Can you move your mouth back a little bit from the receiver and see if we can...
Okay, is this better?
Yeah, that's much better, actually.
Okay, I guess I was holding it too close. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's good. We'll continue then. So the arms race really took off after President Kennedy, who, you know, nearly blew up the world with the Cuban Missile Crisis, decided to move the testing underground. And it wasn't just because of Russia's initiative, it was because there was a huge outcry, particularly in the United States, against the fallout that was happening. And it was people like Barry Commoner, Linus Pauling and others who said that this radioactive fallout was getting into the milk and into children's bones, and that they could get leukemia and cancer. And so Jack Kennedy heard the women. Was the women who really moved, the mothers.
Right, I was going to say, it was really a women-led movement.
A women-led movement, which most peace movements have been, actually. And he then started testing underground. But because that was better for the sort of health of the people of the United States and indeed the world, because they're exposed to less radioactive fallout, it was not better for the health of the world long term, because as you point out, that was the beginning of a massive nuclear buildup by the United States, right? And Russia.
And Russia. And the, yeah, and the Soviet, it was still the Soviet Union at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. That's right. And so as we, I mean, so there was always a popular movement for a comprehensive test ban treaty because, I mean, started by the women who were concerned about the health impacts of the radioactive fallout from the above ground test, and then it and then carrying on because it was widely believed that ending nuclear testing altogether would make it impossible to maintain nuclear arsenals or for new countries to develop nuclear weapons, and so it would be a disarmament measure. And that's what most of the countries in the world also believe, which is why a comprehensive test ban treaty has kind of been the holy grail, if you will, of the nuclear disarmament movement. But now we move into the 90s. We move the 80s, and the high point of the nuclear arsenals is right about coincides with the end of the Soviet Union. And
okay, wait a minute. How many at the end of the Soviet Union, at the end of the Cold War, how many nuclear weapons, mostly hydrogen bombs, did America own, and how many did the Soviets own in total?
I think there were over 80,000 altogether, and I cannot give you the breakdown at this point. I just don't remember without looking at it.
Yeah, I think there were about 40,000 in America. So that was enough to overkill every human being on Earth, what, 20 times or something? I mean, that was a Pentagon expression, overkill.
Yeah.
You kill them, they stand up again. You kill them, they stand. So there were a total of 80,000. So then after the Cold War ended, what happened to those arsenals, Jackie Cabasso?
Well, there were... Well, first of all, a kind of a global sociological phenomenon took place, which is that everybody everywhere kind of breathed a collective sigh of relief that there hadn't been a nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And a lot of people who had been actively working for nuclear disarmament, you know, kind of just put it out of their minds and went on to other things. And it also, I think, coincided with the demographic of a lot of the activists who went on to have families and so on. But there were a lot of other issues that people became engaged in, opposing the U.S. wars of intervention in Central America, the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, some of the environmental movements and so on. And at the same time, the U.S. and Russia did negotiate some arms control agreements, which did bring the numbers of nuclear weapons down to where they are now at about 25,000 altogether, most of those in the hands of the U.S. and the Soviet and Russia about equally. Unless you were in a community, an activist in a community that had a nuclear weapons factory, like the Livermore Lab, it generally went out of sight, and you weren't aware of it. So for those of us who were monitoring the activities at our local facilities, we saw very quickly that the nuclear weapons establishment started to come up with new justifications for continuing with the nuclear weapons enterprise. And after the budget dropped a little bit in the early 90s, they started climbing again. So now the nuclear weapons budget, just for the warheads, is about 1.5 times the Cold War average, even adjusted for inflation. So it's about $6.5 billion now a year just for the warheads. And in that discussion, nobody talks about the delivery system. But actually, the delivery systems, the intercontinental ballistic missiles, the submarine-launched missiles, sea-launched ballistic missiles, and the bombers, have been upgraded and are being upgraded, and that's probably more worrisome than the warheads. And if you take that total amount of money, it's about, last year it was about $52.4 billion altogether. which is more than the entire military budgets of almost every other country, except for a few exceptions, Russia, China, and France.
So what were these nefarious plans that the labs developed to get more money when the Cold War was over, to experiment on new nuclear weapons? What were their plans, Jackie?
Well, I think their plans are, first, I mean, one of their plans is just to keep themselves in business, although that is certainly not the entire plan. But they have created a role for themselves where they are indispensable to quote-unquote national security. And as the post-Cold War doctrines unfolded, we no longer have the luxury of having a specific enemy to plan for. We have to plan for the possibility that any country is our enemy. That was something that General Colin Powell said in about 1992. And so the laboratories, very helpfully, started planning for all kinds of unexpected contingencies. And so their rationale was, we have to be prepared and ready to respond to anything that might develop anywhere, anytime in the future. And
with nuclear weapons, in other words,
yes,
with annihilation.
And with a nuclear weapon that is suitable for the job. So in the 90s, there were programs exploring low-yield nuclear weapons and so-called mini-nukes.
And what about dial-a-yield?
Dial-a-yield actually is a feature, as I understand it, that is in all of the current nuclear weapons, which makes them...
Well, describe what it is.
It's a feature of the weapon that allows the size of the yield, the blast, to be predetermined, so it can be set to a relatively low yield or a very high yield. In the 1990s, under Clinton, I mean, this is how the rhetoric of this all works. The labs were in. I mentioned that the supposed purpose of stockpile stewardship was to maintain the safety and reliability of the enduring nuclear arsenal.
Well, you need to define what reliability means.
Absolutely.
Means.
And those words, safety and reliability, were always uttered as if there were no spaces between them. And they mean very different things. Safety means having features in the weapon to make sure that it doesn't detonate accidentally. And I support that as long as they exist. But reliability means that the weapon will detonate with the precise yield and other performance characteristics that the designers intended. And as it turns out, some of the safety features could impair the yield. And so apparently some of the last tests that were done at the Nevada test site before the testing moratorium entered in 1992 were conducted to make sure, they were called safety tests, but they were to test whether the safety feature would impair the size of the blast. Now, why do you need to know with precision what the size of the blast is going to be, or the other performance characteristics, if you want to use the weapon for a first strike?
Well, what's the first? You've got to explain to the audience, Jackie Cabasso, what is a first strike?
A first strike is the use of a nuclear weapon to take out a specific target, usually a military target or a deeply buried or hardened underground target. Let me talk about deterrence for a minute, because nuclear weapons are always justified and continue to be justified as nuclear deterrence. And I think what that sounds like to most people is that, okay, nobody would dare strike the United States with a nuclear weapon because they would know that we would retaliate overwhelmingly and destroy them. But that's never been what deterrence is. Deterrence has always been premised on threatened first use or first strike, meaning don't think about hitting us because we'll hit you first. And Let me read you a recent document that's really not a document, just a short sentence. Because we've talked about the numbers of nuclear weapons, but it's not just about the numbers. This is a September 2008 Department of Defense report on the Air Force's nuclear mission. And it describes the importance of nuclear deterrence this way. Though our consistent goal has been to avoid actual weapons use, the nuclear deterrence is used every day by assuring friends and allies, dissuading opponents from seeking peer capability to the United States, deterring attacks on the United States and its allies from potential adversaries, and providing the potential to defeat adversaries if deterrence fails.
Translate that into lay language, Jackie, so everyone can understand what this jargon means.
Well, it means it's kind of like the way a bank robber uses a gun by holding the gun to the head of the teller.
Mm.
The United States is threatening nuclear attack every single day to preserve the peace.
On whoever.
That's what that means.
Or to allow the United States to do whatever it wants to around the world.
Yeah,
with
well,
impunity.
Right, that's what it means by preserving the peace.
Taking
right.
oil and, yeah.
Right. And talking, so I was talking about this little story about safety and reliability. So under the Clinton administration, these safety features were being added to the existing warheads. And there was a safety modification, something that was described in a document as a safety modification to a B-61 gravity bomb.
What's a B-61 gravity bomb?
It is a bomb. It is a bomb that is dropped out of an aircraft,
uh-huh.
as opposed to a warhead that is delivered by a missile.
Right.
And it turned out, when we looked into that a little bit, that there were about 50 Cold War leftovers, Cold War era gravity bombs, I think it was called a B-83, that had a huge, like 9 megaton yield. The bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki were between 10 and 15 kilotons.
And a kiloton is 1,000 tons of TNT. And a megaton
right.
is equivalent to 1 million tons of TNT. So that's 9
right.
million tons of TNT.
Right.
Yeah.
And so apparently these B-83 bombs didn't have this insensitive high explosive. So they didn't have the safety feature. But it also turned out that they were too big and heavy physically to carry on modern bombers, airplanes. Aircraft. So instead of just taking them out of service and dismantling them, they were replaced with this modified B-61 gravity bomb, which is a smaller, lighter bomb. It was given, that modified bomb was given some earth-penetrating capability so that it could burrow into the ground before detonating. It was given this dial-a-yield feature so that it could be set relatively low or relatively high, and it was fitted to a new kind of a bomber, a B-2 stealth bomber, the stealth bomber that doesn't show up on radar.
Because it's painted with plastic.
Yeah, and yeah. President Clinton covertly threatened its use against Libya, which he accused of having a secret underground chemical weapon storage facility, which turned out later to be a big empty hole in the ground. So that's how a safety feature, they described something as a safety feature to cover up the development and deployment of a nuclear weapon with a new military capability and a new delivery system.
I want people listening to this program to realize that we're actually talking about psychosis, psychotic thinking. There's a split between reality and perception of reality with these scientists who use this language, which, if you dissect it, is absolutely obscene from a humanity point of view. But this is the way they live their lives, and it all sounds really professional and all together. And if you don't indulge in really critical thinking the way Jackie Cabasso does, you think that, oh, yeah, that sounds okay. No, it's national security and the like. Would you agree with that, Jackie?
I absolutely do agree with you. And the discourse has become so distorted that it's very, very difficult to convey what's going on to ordinary people, or even for example, to anti-war activists who are sympathetic but who don't follow nuclear issues closely.
Yeah.
Just today, I was asked to look at a list of demands for Congress from people in the legislative working group of United for Peace and Justice had put together. And these are people who are mostly focusing on the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and want to be supportive. And it said ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty as one of the demands. And so we've just spent, you know, half an hour sort of dissecting what that's likely to mean unless there are significant changes in policy. And trying to communicate this in a short way is difficult, particularly when, let me just throw something else in here to illustrate how distorted the discourse is. A member of Congress named Ellen Tauscher, whose district includes the Livermore Lab, has just been nominated to serve as the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. And she is one of the big champions of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Well, in 2007, here's what she said about ratification of the treaty. She said, if new warheads can be deployed without live explosive testing, then ratifying the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty should be the central objective of our nation.
Oh, dear.
And if a normal person hears this,
I thought she was a champion of nuclear disarmament, Ellen Tauscher.
Yes, well, she says that, keeping nuclear weapons out of the hands of terrorists, making sure other countries do not obtain them, and one day, I hope, ridding the world of these terrible weapons has become my passion, and I hope my life's work, as long as we can ratify new nuclear, as long as we can deploy new warheads without full-scale testing. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. If you analyze this sort of talk, in fact, the real terrorists are the military and the weapons labs in the United States. I mean, they are overt terrorists because they are threatening at any minute of any day, in fact, to either annihilate a nation of 20 million people or, in fact, the world of 6.72 billion people, and no one really picks them up on this. This is insanity.
Well, nuclear deterrence is terrorism. That's what it is.
Yeah. Do that, or let us do this, or we'll blow you up.
Yeah. You know, I've said that at a couple of conferences, which this is really very funny, but I was giving some points. Terrorists already have nuclear weapons and are making plans to use them again, is what I said.
And what happened?
Big double take from the audience. And afterwards, somebody came up and actually was a former FBI agent or CIA agent and said, do you have information? You know, how do you know this? And I said, listen to what I said. Making plans to use them again. Who could that be? Only the United States has used them in war, although other countries threaten their use as well.
In the whole arms control community, arms control and the like, tell me how many people actually think clearly about this, Jackie Cabasso, without getting caught in the rhetoric and the jargon and the rubbish that is used at an official level? How many people do you think really understand at a deep psychological level what this is all about?
Well, I have to say very few. And part of the reason for that is structural, because what I mean by that is it's become very professionalized. And in order to get money from foundations, for example, you can't say the things that I'm saying.
Why? What do they do?
The foundations really are not interested in rocking the boat, the status quo. The foundations tend to be associated with the wealthy elites, and they're very comfortable in their lifestyles. And some of these things, if we're really talking about fundamentally reconceptualizing security through non-nuclear and non-military means, then some of the people with the most stuff are going to have to give some of it up and share it, you know. So the problem is that if you want to engage with the politicians and the elites, then you have to convince yourself that that much smaller steps are what are practical and achievable and so on and so forth, and you can't really get down to dealing with the basics, which is what I'm trying to talk about here. So it's really unfortunate because right now, for example, regarding the test ban treaty, which we've talked about a little bit, there are some, a group of foundations gave a consortium of groups a big grant to push for the ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Senator Kerry has just introduced an initiative to hurry it along. And we hear from other colleagues who are talking to well-placed people that the cost of getting Republican senators to vote for ratification is going to involve some, again, safeguards, that word again, which even may include a new delivery system.
Oh, my God.
And so
these Republicans are so out to lunch.
But the problem is, since you asked the question the way you did, it's what's distressing to me is that most of the arms control professionals are going to at least go along with the existing reinforcing of the existing stockpile stewardship program as a condition, and aren't going to challenge it. Let me some more language. The question of what is a new nuclear weapon. You know, the last few years, it's been fashionable in arms control circles to oppose new nuclear weapons, and so they have succeeded in cutting the funding for something called the Reliable Replacement Warhead.
Which is?
A new warhead, but to replace an existing one.
Warhead is a hydrogen bomb, everyone, a hydrogen bomb.
Yeah. But at the same time, there's another part of the program which is called the Stockpile Life Extension Program. See, they're not only giving them health care, but they're also extending their lives. And that under that program, every nuclear weapon type in the existing arsenal is having its parts replaced so that its service life will be extended, so it will be safe and reliable for decades to come. And some of them are being given new military capabilities, like the W-76, which is the name of the warhead that is carried on the Trident submarines, which are patrolling the oceans at the same rate as they were during the Cold War. And these
14
yeah,
of them.
14 of them. And these things have a yield of 100 or 150 kilotons again. So they've given the W-76 the capability to explode closer to the target, which again makes it more suitable for the kind of a first strike that we were talking about a little bit earlier. And every arms control community silent on this. So this is
a first strike means that you hit Russia, I'll just walk through a sort of first strike scenario so that America, quotes, wins the nuclear war. First, you take out Moscow and you decapitate Moscow because that's where Putin is and that's the person who can press the button and launch the Russian missiles. So the Russian missiles are still in the ground. And then you have exceedingly accurate missiles on the American side, two of which, or two hydrogen bombs, are meant to explode right on or very near the missile silos so that they actually excavate them and destroy the missiles. And this is what the W-76 is about on the Trident. And then you see you've won the nuclear war because Russia has no weapons to launch, except if a few are missed in the first strike, America setting up a missile defense system to knock out a few hydrogen bombs hurtling through space towards America. And because the Russians are very concerned that they're going to lose their arsenal before they have a chance to launch it to annihilate the United States, Canada, Europe, Australia and the like, they've got a system called the Dead Hand, where they launch a missile from the Ural Mountains with radio signals that can launch all the Russian missiles without any human input by computer, just before America does its first strike and destroys all their missiles. Is that correct, Jackie?
That's one scenario, yeah. There are many, but yeah.
I don't think people really, you know, understand. We slip over this language too ourselves,
yeah,
without really explaining. And I think, do you know, it occurs to me as we talk, Jackie Cabasso, that the work that the Physicians for Social Responsibility did was, which was to describe what happens if a hydrogen bomb, for instance, drops on New York, and there are 60 targeted as we speak on New York, that it would, you know, annihilate or vaporize everyone within a 5-mile radius and produce lethal third-degree burns within a 20-mile radius. This is a big bomb. And produce a holocaust or firestorm of 3,000 square miles. I think it's only when people can almost smell the burning flesh, see the eyeballs melting and running down the cheeks, seeing the charcoalized statues of people and relating it to themselves and their families and where they live and their own country, that cuts through like a sharp knife or a dissecting knife all this rubbish and verbiage that is used to produce a kind of psychic numbing in the average citizen, let alone the average politician. Would you agree with that, Jackie?
I would, and I'm glad you said the average politician, because I meant to say this earlier when you asked me about Clinton. I don't think most of the elected officials have a clue, actually. I don't think they've ever thought about what nuclear weapons actually are and what the effects actually are and what the effects actually would be if one was used and what might result, you know, and so on. It's not helped any by the way the media coverage or lack of media coverage. You know, it was very interesting six weeks or so ago when it was reported that a French nuclear submarine and a British nuclear submarine had collided in the Atlantic.
Yeah, yeah.
And I heard a few stories about that, but never in the U.S. press did they mention, and by the way, the U.S. has 14 of these things out there all the time, you know. It was just like a silent thing. And then I had some speaking engagements after that, and I used that as a way of introducing the idea that there were these U.S. subs. And then people would say, I didn't know France had any nuclear submarines. I mean, it's what really amazes me, and I can't understand this, and maybe you can as a medical professional, but how is it that the issue that was in the foremost of people's public consciousness not that long ago in the 1980s just like dropped off a cliff and nobody remembers? It's like it just disappeared. It's amazing.
Well, I think it's because, as you said earlier, Jackie, that the Cold War ended and we're all so exhausted having helped to bring that about. We lay on our couches like couch potatoes and thought, thank God that's over, assuming that people like Clinton, who seemed to be a good-hearted fellow, would initiate, you know, global nuclear disarmament, which and the opposite has happened. So that brings me now to President Obama. Jackie Cabasso, would you like to analyse where you think he stands both in understanding the reality of what we've been discussing, like mass murder with these weapons, and those labs really are labs for mass murder? I mean, we could use some analogies in history, actually. Does he understand that at a deep psychological soul level? Where do you think he's actually going? Because I think he has a lot of hidden agendas, which he hasn't yet revealed. And I think he's a clever not a scheming politician, but he's a clever politician. What would be your analysis now of President Obama, Jackie Cabasso? Not the people he has around him, but he himself.
I you know, that is a very hard question for me to answer because I don't know anything about him except what I've read and what I've seen. He seems to be, he definitely has an agenda or many agendas. I wish, for many reasons, but I wish that he wasn't handed a collapsing economy right away because we might have known what his agendas were a little bit more clearly. He's very driven. He's very smart. He seems to be a thoughtful person, a person capable of learning and reasoning.
And analyzing.
But he has surrounded himself with a wide range of people, but not enough of them are to our way of thinking as I would like them to be. But, for example, his national science advisor, John Holdren, is somebody who has been very outspoken about the reality of nuclear weapons and the need to get rid of them. I think I started off this interview by saying that Obama campaigned on a pledge that he wanted to lead the world to the elimination of nuclear weapons. But then the next sentence always is, as long as nuclear weapons exist, I will maintain a robust nuclear deterrent. And we've kind of unpacked that a little bit. So those statements are contradictory. Now, which part of it does he mean? Does he understand the relationship between the two parts? Is it something he's going to learn as he goes along, as other presidents have?
Or is he covering his back so that he doesn't get attacked by the military and the labs at this particular stage while working on his own agenda? You know,
that may be. We're going to see some clues, I think, coming out of his meeting with Medvedev next week in London. We'll see some clues with the U.S. Position at the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference coming up in May of 2010, but sooner than that, in May of this year, the preparatory committee meeting for the 2010 review of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And I suppose we'll see it with his budget requests and so on, but the early indications on the budget request, again, for whatever reason, the Department of Energy budget for fiscal year 2010, the outline of it, which is all we have, is the same as or a little bit higher than the current level. And it specifically says we are not funding the reliable replacement warhead, but we are adding increased funding for the enhanced stockpile life extension program, which is what I described to you earlier.
And the people should know the Department of Energy is responsible for making and maintaining all the hydrogen bombs. And people should know, too, that there's a group of very refined scientists called the Jasons who say that the bombs in the arsenal at the moment will last 100 years without, you know, any need to upgrade them. Not that we need them. We need to get rid of them.
That's right.
Jackie, go on.
I was just going to say, I just want to also underscore the relevance of the U.S. commitment to maintaining overwhelming conventional military superiority, because that is a real barrier to nuclear abolition. The Russians have made it quite clear now that they are interested in strategic stability, what they call strategic stability, and they say they need nuclear weapons to counter U.S. conventional military superiority. Yeah. So we have to... I mean, what I like to say, in a nutshell, is that nuclear disarmament, the way we should talk about it and advocate for it and work is that nuclear disarmament should serve as the leading edge of a global trend towards demilitarization and redirection of resources to meet human needs and to save the environment. And I don't think we can look at it as a single issue or work on it as a single issue in isolation from those other issues.
No. Well, Jackie, I think we've reached the end of our time. It's been a fascinating conversation, and you indeed are one of the founding mothers of the abolition movement. And if you've been turned on by what Jackie's been saying, it's very important that we now all band together and work together and produce a massive nuclear disarmament movement similar to the one that we had in the 80s. Jackie, where can people access your information? Do you have a web page?
Yes. Our website for Western States Legal Foundation is www.wslfweb.org.
And there's a huge amount of information right. on that.
I would also direct people to the Abolition 2000 website, abolition2000.org. And also, I've been doing a lot of my nuclear disarmament advocacy in the context of United for Peace and Justice, which is in the United States, www.unitedforpeace.org, which is the anti-war movement, which has taken up abolition as part of their connected
yes.
set of issues.
And if anyone is a religious person listening to this program, clearly this is the number one issue that religious people should be working on. In other words, how to save the creation, God's creation, if you will.
Yes, yes, and many of the world's religions do have positions and so on. There are progressive groups like Pax Christi, the Catholic Peace Organization, and other such organizations.
Yes. Well, Jackie, I want to thank you not just for this wonderful interview, but for all the work that you've done over the years and your total commitment and dedication to saving the planet. It's been a great pleasure and privilege to interview you, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Ellen, and it's a great pleasure and privilege to know you and to work with you.
Thank you, Jackie.
Okay, take care.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet is Jacqueline Cabasso, Executive Director of the Western States Legal Foundation in California, recipient of the 2008 Sean McBride Peace Prize, and a leading voice for nuclear weapons abolition. Thank you for listening today, and we'll be back with you in a week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.